From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Can the Democrats deliver a better deal? Hello again, I'm Orrin Almy, and this is To the Point. Bill Clinton's winning campaigns for the White House operated on the basic premise that it's the economy, stupid. But last year it was Donald Trump who appealed to working class and rural voters, those the Democrats now call left out and left behind by economic changes. Their new slogan, A Better Deal, starts with increased wages, lower drug prices, and the end of corporate mergers. Polls show Democrats are the party against President Trump, but to win elections, they have to favor something, too. We'll hear what they want it to be. Later on today's Talking Point, President Trump talks politics at the Boy Scout Jamboree. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
We're not only back with To the Point. Since Donald Trump's upset of Hillary Clinton last year, Democrats have lost four special elections in different parts of the country. Now they're trying to persuade voters that they are more than just the party against President Trump. We'll hear their opening offers. Today's Talking Point, last night in West Virginia, President Trump addressed a large crowd with his standard speech about Hillary Clinton, fake media, and a threat to fire one of his cabinet members. But it wasn't a political rally. Today, the Boy Scouts of America are protesting that they're wholly nonpartisan. First, this news update. President Trump got something he wanted today. The chance of repealing Obamacare is still alive in the Senate. There was a tie vote on whether to begin debate, broken by Vice President Mike Pence. It's not yet clear what's in the bill, but the president was gratified.
We passed it without one Democrat vote. And that's a shame, but that's the way it is, and it's very unfortunate. But I want to congratulate American people because we're going to give you great health care.
Despite a recent diagnosis of brain cancer, Republican John McCain traveled to Washington from Arizona to vote for debate, even though he opposes the current options.
I will not vote for this bill as it is today.
McCain decried what he sees as a decline in Senate procedures.
Asking us to swallow our doubts and force it past a unified opposition. I don't think that's going to work in the end, and probably shouldn't.
Jeffrey Young covers healthcare for HuffPost. Good to have you with us.
Oh, good to be back, Warren.
So what is in this bill that the senator doesn't want to talk about?
Well, I can't really tell you, and the reason is that Senator McCain and the rest of them don't know either, and I don't mean that in a glib way. You know, if people recall, a week or two ago, there was a Senate bill that the leadership was calling their Obamacare repeal and replacement bill. But there wasn't enough support for that bill. Provisions of it that some folks were worried that Medicaid cuts were too big. Other folks were worried it didn't deregulate insurance enough and undo enough of the Affordable Care Act. So Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, had pulled that bill from consideration. It's now kind of back in the mix, but so is another one that just repeals parts of Obamacare without replacing it with anything. And then there's another thing which just started circulating this morning in the public view anyway, that would simply get rid of the individual mandate that most people get health coverage, the employer mandate that large companies have to offer health benefits to their employees, and a tax on medical devices, and do nothing else. So for those senators who went in today to vote on this procedural motion to keep this thing alive, none of them actually know what they're proceeding to debate to, which is exceptionally weird because the process they're using to do this only gives them a few days to wrap this whole thing up.
And, of course, they are doing it on an absolutely partisan basis. One of the things John McCain said today was that the Democrats in 7 years ago never should have passed without any opposition votes a massive social welfare program as they did, or social services program. And he said, we shouldn't do the same thing. So also, as some of those who said they will vote no on the bill Senator Capito of West Virginia, Rand Paul of Kentucky, Dean Heller of Nevada, all said that they would support debate, but not the bill itself. So you wonder, how far have we gone?
Yeah, and it's hard to see what an outcome is from here, in a way, crossing this very important hurdle. Because, of course, if this vote had failed, then there would be this would be over in the Senate, or at least they'd have to sort of start over again. But what's a little curious is just picking up some of the names you just mentioned. So take Senator McCain. It seems to me that if his concern that this process has been too partisan and too rushed and too unusual, and he wanted to really make that point, he could have voted no instead. But he voted yes to keep that very same process he was just criticizing moving. And then if you look at senators like Dean Heller from Nevada and Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia, they talked about concern about massive loss of insurance coverage, huge cuts to Medicaid. Well, those things are still on the table. And if they're taken off the table, then you lose a huge chunk of Republicans who want to do those things because they don't believe that the government should be spending all that money to give people health care. So they have definitely made tangible progress by getting to the floor, but they haven't seemingly resolved any of the divisions within the Republican Party and the Senate on this thing. And not to mention that if you look at, say, again, Senator Heller, who expressed deep concern about the fate of people in Nevada who are on Medicaid, if he votes for something at the end of this, it seems highly unlikely it'll be because his concerns were addressed. It will be more like he just decided he wasn't that concerned after all. It's impossible to predict which way a senator in his position would actually vote without knowing what they're being asked to vote on.
We know there's been a huge amount of political pressure, much of it coming from the Trump White House and, of course, Senator McConnell as well, who's the only one who appears to know what they might ultimately end up voting on. You have said yourself that Obamacare has had a lot of near-death experiences. This one is its gravest yet, but maybe not.
It's entirely possible that this thing does not survive the week, especially if there are so many moving pieces. If they can't figure out some, because they have to get to 50 again. And in some cases, some of the things that Republican senators want to do to amend this bill on the floor would actually require 60 votes because it would be subject to a Democratic filibuster.
All right. In any case, we'll both have a lot to do between now and the end of the week. And Jeff Young with HuffPost, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
In a moment, can the Democrats deliver a better deal? This is To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. Democratic leaders from New York and San Francisco showed up yesterday in Berryville, Virginia, a town of 4,000 people. Their message, the Democratic Party has not lost touch with the rural or blue-collar voters who made Republican Donald Trump America's president in last year's election. Here's the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer from New York City.
We are here today to tell the people of Berryville and the working people of America, someone has your back.
Schumer conceded the Democrats need to be more than a party of sour grapes.
Too many Americans don't know what we stand for. Not after today. President Trump campaigned on a populist platform, talking to working people. That's why he won. But as soon as he got into office, he abandoned them.
Heather Cagle is congressional reporter for Politico. Good to have you on our show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what are the Democrats trying to do in a very remote town most people have never heard of, with Schumer of New York and Pelosi of San Francisco going down to tell us we've got your back?
Yeah, I mean, you summed it up pretty well. They went to a county that won for Trump by 55%. It's a county that's in a district that they need to win if they want to regain some power in Congress next year. So they got out of Washington. It's about an hour and a half drive. And they said, look, We're not just here to represent New York City and San Francisco and California. We understand your issues, and we will fight for you. And that's what they tried to do yesterday. Whether it's successful, you know, remains to be seen, but that was their big rollout.
They drew a lot of television cameras and radio reporters and others, including yourself from Politico, but what about people in that town? Did they show up? Was it there a crowd?
There actually was a crowd. I did kind of a rough count. There was somewhere between about 175 to 200 people. I'm not sure how many people live in this town. It's a wonderful little town. I've never been there, but there was a beautiful little main street. Obviously not a huge metropolis, though, so I feel like 200 was a pretty good showing. A lot of them, actually, they had seats reserved for the press, but a lot of these people just came and sat in the seats, so most of the press were standing off to the side, you know, watching this press conference. But they did have good turnout. They also had some protesters come, too, so that was interesting.
Okay, they've come up with a slogan, and they have indicated three issues in particular that they want to emphasize. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so their slogan, they've poll-tested this for several months. It's called A Better Deal. And then within that, it is better jobs, better wages, a better future. And so that's basically what they hope to hammer home over the next several months until, you know, the midterms in November 2018. We actually reported that it was going to be called A Better Deal probably 3 or 4 weeks ago before anybody else had that. And the reason that's interesting is because they're trying to channel Franklin Roosevelt, who ushered in, you know, what we think of as the modern-day Democratic Party, but also kind of take a dig at Donald Trump, who has billed himself, you know, for the last 2-3 years as the world's greatest deal maker, and that's part of the reason why people put him in office, because he said he can get things done. So that's where they got that. The second part, though, the better jobs, better wages, better future, that came out last week, and you saw a lot of people on Twitter instantly react and kind of make fun of it and say it reminded them of Papa John's, which has, you know, better ingredients, Papa John's. So I don't know how well it will be received. They even admit, though, they say it's not about the slogan itself. It's more about just the overall message hit home with working class voters, and do they hear what Democrats are trying to sell them?
And the play on FDR, of course, is that he had the New Deal. Now
right.
We're going to have a better deal, if that's possible, in this century. Heather Cagle, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Congressional reporter for Politico. Andrew Hartman is a professor of history at Illinois State University, author of A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. Professor, good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
How does this fit into the history of divisions in the Democratic Party? Because obviously they are divided after the stunning defeat last year.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it the most obvious division on the left side of the American political spectrum right now, and you've seen this play out in the Democratic Party, particularly in the 2016 primaries for presidency, and the division between Bernie Sanders supporters and Hillary Clinton supporters. The most obvious division is generational. Young people in general tend to be further to the left than older Democrats, and thus their support for Bernie Sanders, and thus I think the Democratic Party sort of hinting that perhaps now is the time to move a little bit leftwards, as seen with this new sort of platform. The most obvious historical analogy is to go back to the 1960s. You might sort of use the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago as an example, when you had tens of thousands of young people, college students and other young people in the streets protesting the convention, but also young people trying to sort of make their way into the party and who were denied access to the party. But that division, I think, although generational, similar to now with the young people further to the left, was about the Vietnam War, a few other issues like the civil rights movement, but mostly about the Vietnam War. And now you're seeing the major divide being economic, sort of hearkening back to the 1930s. And ever since 2008, I think young people have come of age, especially come on to the job market with far less opportunity than their parents and grandparents, and I think that has precipitated this move leftward.
Andrew Hartman at Illinois State. Matt Bennett is with us, Democratic strategist, Vice President for Public Affairs at Third Way. That's a nonprofit strategy center for centrist Democrats. There was, of course, a major lesson that occurred 4 years after 1968. The Democrats did go left. They nominated George McGovern to be their candidate in 1972, and he won exactly one state, the state of Massachusetts. Would you say that that was a cautionary moment?
Without question, and what we don't want to see is "don't blame me, I'm from Massachusetts" bumper stickers sprouting up in 2021. Look, Democrats are in the worst electoral shape that they've been in since Reconstruction. If you look at every level, obviously the White House and Congress, but governorships and state legislative seats, it's a pretty seriously catastrophic situation for Democrats. Since 2009, at the kind of apex of power, when Obama had majorities in both houses of Congress, we've lost 1,000 state legislative seats. We've gone from controlling two-thirds of state legislative chambers to one-third. So, to your point, there's a really serious danger here for Democrats if they don't kind of get their act together. I think yesterday's rollout was a piece of that, but there's a lot more work to be done to craft a message that can appeal broadly, not only to the millennials that the professor was talking about, but broadly to the entire electorate.
Let me get a view from another direction, from Tamara Drought, who is Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos. That's a nonpartisan public research organization. She's also author of Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Can you answer the question you raise in your title? How can the new working class transform America, and what does that have to do with the next election?
Well, you know, I think when we talk about the working class, we have to be really careful not to confine that to sort of the old archetype of the industrial working class. People like my dad, hard hat, worked in a factory. Today's working class are much more likely to be women, and they're much more likely to be people of color, and they're working in these service sector jobs that don't come with benefits that professional folks, like I think everybody on this phone, enjoys, things like paid leave, a decent wage, retirement benefits. So what I think is really key here is that absolutely the Democrats have to go back to their history, to their roots, and be the party of the working class and be the champion of the working class. And what I like about what was unveiled is, one, it talks about wages, it talks about benefits, it talks about the need to have paid leave. But two, it makes it really clear that the Democrats believe government should have the back of the people. And it's been a very long time since you've seen the Democrats actually run on using the role of government to improve people's lives. For a very long time, they've been told to be timid, to not be supportive and overtly championing the role of government. And I think that's a pretty big shift, and one that, you know, polls that Demos have done, and I believe CBS found the same thing. For the first time in a generation, the American people actually say they want our government to do more, not less, to meet the needs of the people. And that there's only one political party in this country that believes government should be doing that, and that's the Democratic Party, and they really need to lean into that.
Again, Tamara Drought at Demos. Let me go back to Matt Bennett, our Democratic strategist, on the issue of what happened after 1972. When Mr. McGovern lost as badly as he did, that was when Democrats began to be told to be timid and don't talk that way anymore because it scares voters away. So what about that? Has that turned out not to be successful?
Well, I think timidity is one way of putting it. I don't think that's certainly been true some of the time in our history, but not all. And look, 72 was a very different moment. There was a very different kind of rage, as you were discussing earlier with your other guest about Vietnam. But what we're seeing now, I think there is some truth to the idea that voters desperately want Washington in particular, and even in state capitals, to be responsive to the things that they are struggling with in their lives. The anxiety in their life is that they or their kids won't have the opportunity to live a good life. And that is profoundly terrifying for a huge percentage of Americans. And they do want government to help them manage the tectonic shifts that they are seeing in the economy, both from globalization and from technology. And I agree that yesterday was a step in that direction, but there's a lot more work that needs to be done if Democrats are going to be responsive to that need. In addition to the polling that was just discussed about the role of government, people are deeply, deeply skeptical of both parties. The Democratic Party brand is horrendous at the moment. Only about 28% of voters trust Democrats to do the right thing. Most don't trust government to do the right thing. Having Donald Trump as president isn't going to help. So it's a very complicated path ahead for Democrats.
Let me go back to our first guest, or second guest, Andrew Hartman at Illinois State University. You said that the split was largely generational. Do you agree that it also has to do, as we heard from Tamara Drought, with women in the workplace and the people of color in the workplace? Hasn't it changed a lot because of that?
Yes, the demographics in terms of sex and gender and race have changed dramatically, but the underlying principles I don't think have changed, and that is that I think young people and working class people are increasingly in need of a party that supports them, and I don't think they've had that for quite some time. I think that 1972 is a really bad historical analogy in terms of the one thing that's similar is the generational gap, but there's major differences, and that is that the young people were sort of in many ways out of touch with a broad stretch of the mainstream America. But I would say young people are very much in touch with a wide swath of mainstream America, especially Democrats, working class people, and that has a lot to do with the fact that they support sort of populist economic issues like universal health care. That's the main cause of people, and I think if the Democrats were to move left on issues like that, I think it would be wildly popular and actually electorally beneficial.
Universal health care, what else?
Free higher education, or sort of just the decommodification of higher education and education in general, I think that would be wildly popular, not just amongst young people, but among a lot of Democrats and others. I think that a fair trade policy would be wildly popular. And I think that, you know, sort of getting beyond rhetoric about job training, which I heard a lot of in this recent Democratic sort of reboot, that's sort of going back to the 1990s. This is how we're going to adjust people to globalization instead of fighting for fair trade policy, instead of fighting for higher wages. We're just going to sort of offer this training for jobs that probably won't be there. So I think the Democratic Party still has a lot of work to do.
Tamara Drought, back to you. What about fairer trade? Do voters, particularly young voters, women voters, voters of color, do they really care about fair trade? Are they focused on it?
Well, I don't think it's a top-tier issue in the way that it is for sort of white, blue-collar folks who, you know, people like my dad, the hometown I grew up in, Middletown, Ohio, that, you know, got used to a way of life, that there was a transmission belt to the middle class from high school graduation to the factory floor. And we haven't replaced that because, again, I would say back to what the Democrats need to do, you know, we have let all of the good union jobs go overseas and then be replaced with low-wage service sector jobs. And we have not, I think, you have not seen the Democratic Party be a real champion and advocate for union rights in this country.
But it's an argument you have to make. It's an indirect kind of association, is it not, with the trade and jobs?
Well, yes and no. But what we do know is that the jobs that are growing in the country today are overwhelmingly the largest source of jobs, don't require a college degree, they don't require any special skills after high school. We can make those good jobs, we can make them union jobs.
All right, hold that thought. We're going to take a very brief break. On our talking point later, President Trump talks politics at the Boy Scout Jamboree. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled.
This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Subscribe to the Point podcast at kcrw.com or download the KCRW app, available anywhere podcasts are found and on all mobile devices.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about the Democratic Party. One of our guests, Matt Bennett of the Third Way, says it's in the worst shape since Reconstruction. The Democrats are trying to put something together, and they're calling it a better deal. Matt Karp is assistant professor of history at Princeton University. He's a contributing editor at Jacobin and a Bernie Sanders supporter. Thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Earlier we heard from Andrew Hartman at Illinois State University that what the voters that they need to get into the Democratic Party are people who are in favor of universal health care, free higher education, and free trade. Those are things that sure sound like Bernie Sanders. Is he a likely candidate to put the party back together and lead the way?
You know, I'm all with my vision is definitely 2020 when it comes to Bernie, but I think it's probably too early, and I'm sure Bernie would agree. For me, what's most significant to get into horse race stuff, what's most significant about this is, as Tamara said, that this is a major rhetorical shift. This is an admission that the economy isn't working for most Americans in the new document and Chuck Schumer's op-ed, that people believe the system is rigged. And let's not forget, these are talking points that were vociferously denied by a lot of figures in the establishment of the party, basically the entire 2016 campaign, right? Hillary Clinton supporters spent most of the time during the primary celebrating the Obama recovery. During the general election, economic anxiety was treated as a punchline for pundits. And Clinton's fateful decision not to embrace the sort of progressive elements in the Democratic platform during her election, but to woo moderate Republicans by attacking Donald Trump's temperament, this is a decision that Schumer himself signed off on very publicly. This is an admission that failed. That strategy failed, and beyond that, in an even more fundamental way, beyond the sort of electoral tactics, that the economy isn't working for people outside the 1%, and the Democrats have gone along with this. I mean, some of Schumer's points about, he said it was the Democrats who let Exxon and Mobil merge, like he just sort of remembered this. I think the details of the proposal for me are insufficient, but the rhetoric is interesting as a step forward for the party.
How important are mergers? They have talked about that as part of the better deal to try to prevent mergers, such as the one you just referred to between Exxon and Mobil. How powerful is that as a issue in campaigns?
Well, I think it's powerful in shaping our political economy. And so I think to the extent that Democrats haven't talked about anti-monopoly, antitrust stuff for a long time, even as the economy is increasingly dominated by ever expanding corporate monoliths, there's room for that. And I think there's potential teeth in some of the anti-monopoly measures that they rolled out. But, you know, there's a lot still missing here. I think when you talk about a better deal for workers and jobs and you don't mention unions in any of your press releases or editorials, that says something not good about where the balance of power within the party is right now. So there's definitely a long way for them to go.
Let me go back to Matt Bennett again with the Third Way, nonprofit strategy center for centrist Democrats. Wouldn't it have been kind of difficult last year, and isn't it somewhat difficult this year, to say that after 8 years of Democratic rule in the White House, the economy's not working for millions of people?
Yeah, I think it was excruciatingly difficult, not only for Hillary, but for Democrats who, incumbent Democrats in Congress. So I think it's a little, it's easy to say that they should have handled differently, but Hillary was essentially running for a third term, and Americans don't hand out third terms very often. There's only been one since FDR, and so that was an enormous challenge for her. I think going forward, when we settle on a nominee for 2020, that person will be completely unbound by that problem and will be able to point out all the ways that the economy is not working for a lot of people and how too many people in too many places just don't have the opportunity to earn a good life.
Well, who do you see coming along? Matt Karp, for good reasons, I suppose, didn't want to advocate Bernie Sanders, even though he's been a Bernie Sanders supporter. Elizabeth Warren has obviously been very prominently mentioned. Don't you have to start to build very early? And presidential campaigns these days take almost 4 years.
Maybe. I mean, Trump proved that all the old lessons that we thought we'd learned about presidential campaigns are completely thrown out the window. He started fairly late. This will be the first presidential cycle since 1976 where there isn't basically an heir apparent for the party. Those people don't always run. Mario Cuomo was that person in 92, and he didn't run, and they don't always win. Hillary was that person in 2008. She obviously lost to Obama. But there's always been somebody on the horizon that Democrats were looking to as the heir apparent, and that person just does not exist right now, and no one knows who that's going to be. But with the rules all suspended, anyone can run. You could see a business person, somebody without political experience. In the Trump era, you know, it's anything goes.
The Democrats are talking not just about the presidency and the Congress, but also about the states where they have lost, as somebody pointed out, I think, thousands of jobs, or maybe 1,000 jobs very recently, and where they are now in control only in a minority of places. Tamara Drought, let me go back to you. Doesn't it take leadership? Doesn't it take the ability to point to somebody as the potential next star of the party? And if so, are there candidates that you would consider important to the constituencies that you have identified, to women, to minorities, for example?
Well, you know, I think absolutely. And I think the Democratic Party needs to spend a lot more resources and energy at, I would say, even the city level, let alone the state level, to begin recruiting new leadership. It's not clear to me who's going to, you know, come to the fore over the next couple of years as we look toward 2020. But I do want to say one thing about this plan is we have to remember, even just 4 years ago, 8 years ago, the Democrats' economic message, you know, there were two big pieces. One was deficit reduction. We had the Bowles-Simpson. You know, the Democrats, especially Obama, used a lot of political capital talking about deficit reduction. The other big thing was about whether or not the Democratic Party should continue the tax cuts under the Bush administration for the middle class. So I think, you know, it is important. There's a lot more details. I want to see something on debt-free college. I think that's critically important for the working class and for young people. But I do want to just put a finer point on what a dramatic shift it is to have a document that talks about we need to be spending money on infrastructure. It doesn't mention deficit reduction. It doesn't mention tax cuts anywhere, but talks about spending, talks about reining in corporate power. That is a pretty remarkable shift for the party's message compared to where we were 4 or 8 years ago.
Matt Karp at Princeton, our Bernie Sanders supporter. What about the charge that comes from the left in the party, that the Democratic establishment is much too much tied up with Wall Street? Obviously, that's a source of campaign money and very important in that respect. But in terms of ideology and in terms of economic benefit, it may not be working out so well.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, Sanders certainly showed that. And you saw a little taste of that, I think, in a clip I saw at the press conference the other day where somebody asked about Glass-Steagall and stricter regulations on Wall Street. Where were they in this new rollout? And you could see Elizabeth Warren practically did a little jig in the corner of the stage while, you know, the speakers deflected the question. I think the party's divided on a lot of these issues. And I think for some on the left, there's a real question, is the party in its current form capable of taking on Wall Street, given not only its kind of its dependence on fundraising? In some ways, that's the least of it. It's sort of deeper institutional ideological partnership with finance and to an extent with Silicon Valley, also not mentioned in any of the monopoly provisions of the rollout, that these two industries have become so fundamental to sort of the Democratic Party as an institution that it's going to be really difficult for the current leadership, however well-intentioned, to challenge them in any fundamental way. And I think there are reasons you know, that critique has real teeth. And there are reasons to be skeptical solutions like, you know, tax credits for job training can really cut into the you know, the grotesque imbalance in power between workers and bosses today.
How do you take on that grotesque imbalance of power directly?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that needs to be front and center, I hope Tamara would agree with me about this, is I think she said it, is labor and the power of workers to unionize. I mean, it's great that the party is moving forward on the minimum wage. That's important. But, you know, the battle cry in places like Birmingham, Alabama today is $15 an hour and a union. And I think it wasn't, you know, it's good that this shift is, we're moving in the right direction. But remember, in 2008, there was a lot of talk about something called card check to the piece of legislation that would make it easier for workers to unionize. And when Obama became president, the financial crisis, he didn't pursue it in any meaningful way. The party didn't pursue it. I think things like that to increase the power of workers within the economy are vital to actually changing the structure of things.
Tamara Drought, what about it?
Couldn't agree more, absolutely. And I think this is a major missing piece because we can, you know, use policy to trim the outside influence of corporations in our economy by not allowing mergers that create monopolies, by getting money out of politics. We absolutely should do those things. But I really do hope that the Democrats, again, find their voice when it comes for sticking up for the rights for people to have economic democracy. It's something that we haven't been talking about as a country, as a political party, for a very long time. And it is a fundamental reason. You know, I think economists show that about a third of the inequality we have today can be attributed to the loss of union density. So I think it's a missing and critical piece. I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to see something, hopefully, about that around Labor Day. That would be the time to make a big announcement on that.
Matt Bennett, back to you. Third Way, your organization, has often been associated with the Democrats' move to rely more on Wall Street and perhaps on Silicon Valley as well. What do you say to what we're hearing? Is it possible to have a Democratic Party that doesn't have Wall Street involved with it, that doesn't have Silicon Valley?
Well, first, I just like to clear something up, Warren. We've been associated that way by people that just disagree with us. It's just not true. We have been very strong supporters, as have the people in the leadership of the Democratic Party now and former President Obama, for very strict regulation of Wall Street, including Dodd-Frank, which needs some shoring up, and we're for that. So there's no question that Democrats pretty much across the spectrum are united in their support for those kinds of things. And I think that there is plenty of room for regulation of industry, Silicon Valley for sure, heavy industrial companies, and certainly the financial sector. That is not something that particularly divides Democrats at the moment. There are policy differences, of course, and I think the most important difference probably is where we believe the emphasis should go, because our view is that the defining economic challenge of our time is that opportunity is vastly too concentrated in certain places and for certain people. There's just not nearly enough opportunity for people to earn the life that they want to live, and that leads to somewhat different, not entirely different, but somewhat different policy outcomes than a strict focus on income inequality. Income inequality is an enormous problem, but we think the bigger problem facing people every day around their kitchen table is how are they or their kids going to earn a good life? And those are the kinds of things we think Democrats ought to focus on.
Andrew Hartman, back to you. Certainly the Trump administration is giving the Democrats plenty of opportunities to challenge Republicans when it comes to corporate issues and the power of corporations as opposed, for example, to unions. Do you think that the battles in Congress, however they may ultimately come out between now and 2020, is it possible that they are places from which national leaders may emerge?
That sounds entirely plausible to me. I live in a historically Republican part of Illinois. A lot of people around here voted for our current far-right governor, Bruce Rauner. But we've seen remarkable local activism on the left here. Democratic meetings have been full of hundreds of people, whereas in the past maybe 10 would attend. The local government is moving left rapidly. And so I think this is something that hopefully is happening in a number of different places across the country, and leaders will emerge. But nobody has so far, and the most popular politician in the country remains Bernie Sanders. And so if he weren't 75, I think he would be talked about as the most likely candidate in 2020 and may still be.
Tamara Drought, I didn't hear anything yesterday. I may have missed it, and haven't heard anything on this program about global warming. Now, what about that? A lot of people are saying that is the major issue that we face.
Absolutely, and I think the Democratic Party has been pretty clear that that they believe in climate change, that we actually need to be doing things right now to build our resilience as a nation. So I think that wasn't in there, one, because one could quibble about, is it economic, is it environmental? But I don't think there's any question. I think that's the least of the party's problems in terms of perception. I think it's pretty clear that the Democratic Party believes we need a really robust intervention to protect the planet.
But then don't you have to argue that on economic terms?
Yes, but I think you also have to argue it on environmental terms, on justice terms. So I think there's definitely a place for that conversation. You know, if I had to guess, my sense is they didn't include it because they wanted to focus more on pocketbook issues. That's not to say that In real life, climate problems will become pocketbook problems, but I think they wanted to, if I had to guess, make a distinction between sort of pure pocketbook issues and separate that from environment.
All right. We will be hearing much more about a better deal. In the meantime, thanks to all of you for being with us today. Tamara Drought of Demos, also author of The Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. Matt Karp at Princeton, contributing editor at The Jacobin and a Bernie Sanders supporter. Matt Bennett with The Third Way, that's a nonprofit strategy center for centrist Democrats. Andrew Hartman at Illinois State University, his book, A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. And our earlier guest with Politico, Heather Cagle. Thank you all very much for being on our program. President Trump and the Boy Scouts of America. In a moment on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Allen here with today's Talking Point. Last night in Glen Jean, West Virginia, President Trump addressed this year's National Boy Scout Jamboree. Here's how he started and what happened after that.
Who the hell wants to speak about politics when I'm in front of the Boy Scouts, right? Do you remember that incredible night with the maps? And the Republicans are red and the Democrats are blue. And that map was so red, it was unbelievable, and they didn't know what to say.
Back to election night at the Boy Scout Jamboree. Ted Genoways is one of a long line of scouts. His own son hopes for his eagle next year. His books include This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
As somebody very much steeped in the Boy Scout traditions and knowledgeable about the history of presidents who are honorary members, I think, and even presidents of the Boy Scouts of America, what's your take on what happened last night?
Well, it was shocking to me, frankly, and truly unprecedented. I mean, since the National Jamboree began in 1937, when it was first held on the Capitol Mall in Washington, D.C., the presidents have always been invited to address the assembled Boy Scouts. And you go back to that first jamboree, all of the boys who were coming from what were then the 48 states were asked to bring wood that they can contribute to the opening campfire. And as the fire was lit, Attorney General Homer Cummings read FDR's words to the boys, encouraging them to take the spirit of the place back home and to go forward in a new spirit of sort of burgeoning citizenship. And that's really been the the spirit in which all presidents since then have addressed the Boy Scouts. In all those years, there's been six of the 10 sitting presidents who were in office at the time of the Jamborees, who have traveled to the Jamboree and addressed the Scouts, and they have universally set aside politics to instead praise the boys who are assembled for their commitment to the Boy Scouts and their commitment to service, and challenge them to go on to be even better young men of similar commitment. And that was, I think, what was to be expected of this president, and he really fell short.
Well, we did hear the president a moment ago saying, well, who the hell wants to speak about politics in front of the Boy Scouts, and then talking on and on about the maps on election night. Here is a Boy Scout and his Scoutmaster in a 1950s dramatization. It comes from the movie Room for One More, reciting the Boy Scout oath.
On my honor, I will do my best to do my duty to God and my country, and to obey the Scout law, to help other people at all times, to keep myself physically strong, mentally awake, and morally straight.
So, Ted Genoways, that's the way we normally think about the Boy Scouts, and that solemn quality that they have, of course, before they go off and start being boys again. But do you think that the president in some way damaged that tradition, that sense of order and respectfulness?
I think he really dishonored that tradition. The Boy Scouts have always said that they consider themselves they are overtly a nonpartisan organization. They welcome boys of all faiths, of all ethnicities and backgrounds, and of all political philosophies. And that is the stated policy of the Boy Scouts. And as I say, going back to 1937, every president who has come and addressed the Scouts has honored that mission and set politics aside to instead talk about shared values and traditions and skills that we want all young people in this country to develop. And to miss that opportunity and to not deliver those kinds of words to an assembled group of 35,000 young men in this country but is bad enough. But then to instead make it all about partisan politics and even worse, all about himself, I think is shows that Trump really has little respect for the Boy Scouts and very little understanding of the organization.
As to the partisan aspect of things, given the political realities of today, people don't agree with each other. And in fact, the president got boos when he mentioned President Obama and Hillary Clinton. The boys and the Scoutmasters apparently were somewhat roiled up by what he said. Doesn't that reflect politics as it is today?
Well, I think what it reflects is that when someone who's in a leadership position chooses to appeal to the worst in the crowd will come out. When that person who's in a position of authority and in a position of power instead chooses to appeal to the best in the crowd, we will see that come out. And I think, unfortunately, what we've seen repeatedly from Donald Trump is an appeal to divide the country and to turn one American on another instead of seeking to unite Americans together. And to do that with a group of boys who are 12 to 18 years old seems to me especially shocking.
I guess the question would be, though, is it possible for any organization at this point to be nonpartisan, given the tenor of the country?
Well, I can only speak to what I've seen, and in my experience, both as a Boy Scout myself and now as an adult member of my son's Boy Scout troop, I see that there are plenty of differing political opinions among the parents and among the boys in the troop. There are people who have very different beliefs, both religious and philosophical, and yet the shared values that everyone sort of rallies around really are binding. And I think that that's an important thing for the country right now. And I would hope that what we do is try to build up the organizations and institutions in this country that ask us to find our commonality, rather than tearing them down and making them just another site of division.
You have been critical yourself of the Boy Scouts from time to time. For example, for the length of time it took them to integrate the organization. Is that one of the reasons you stay there? Are you trying to make sure that they maintain a certain, if I may, progressive attitude toward issues and personal behavior?
Absolutely. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, my son is the fourth generation in our family to be a member of Boy Scouts. And so the organization absolutely belongs to my family and to our beliefs as much as any other family. And that together we make up the mission of the Scouts. And it is certainly my belief that the Scouts needed to have done more in the past where issues of integration are concerned, or bringing mothers into the organization and making use of their talents and skills. And most recently, when I was in Boy Scouts, you know, establishing a policy against gay boys and against gay adults who were wanting to be in leadership positions. But because of many members who stayed in the organization and because of past members who continued to put pressure on the executives of the organization, those positions were reversed in 2013 and 2014. And I think it's an example of how the organization can be molded as long as we remain members and stay engaged.
And, of course, President Obama did not attend the Jamboree in person because of the fact that gay scouts and leaders were not recognized by the Boy Scouts. Did he have an impact on that issue?
I think it certainly did have an impact. That by choosing not to appear in person, it put some additional pressure on the organization. But I would also point out that he recorded video remarks to be played at the Jamboree for the scouts who were assembled. And those remarks did not make mention of the policy that he was protesting. What he did was take the issues up with the executives, with the adults, who were the appropriate audience, and spoke directly to the boys as young men he hoped to encourage.
We only have seconds left, but do you think that President Trump will get another invitation to a Boy Scout Jamboree?
Well, it's been a standing invitation since 1937. I actually hope he will be invited again. I hope that he'll behave better when he is asked to return and allowed to return.
Ted Genoways, again, from a family of Boy Scouts, a Boy Scout himself, author of This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Since Donald Trump's upset of Hillary Clinton last year, Democrats have lost four special elections in different parts of the country. Now they're trying to persuade voters they are more than the party against President Trump. We'll hear their opening efforts. Today's talking point, last night in West Virginia, President Trump addressed a large crowd with his standard speech about Hillary Clinton, fake media, and a threat to fire one of his cabinet members. But it wasn't a political rally. Today, the Boy Scouts of America are protesting. They're wholly nonpartisan. First, this news update. America's top law enforcement officer is in danger of losing his job. After 2 days of caustic presidential tweets about Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about the president's views at today's White House briefing.
Look, I know that he is certainly frustrated and disappointed in the attorney general for recusing himself. But as we've said, I think that's a decision that if the president wants to make, he certainly will. That frustration certainly hasn't gone away. And, I don't think it will.
And it's not just about Sessions recusing himself. In tweets yesterday and today, the president has said, why aren't the committees and investigators and, of course, our beleaguered AG looking into crooked Hillary's crimes and Russia relations? He's attacked him for other things in other tweets. Matt Zapotosky covers the Justice Department for The Washington Post's National Security Team. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Letting your attorney general twist in the wind is not a typical presidential strategy. What's going on here?
It certainly isn't. Pretty much ever since Jeff Sessions recused himself from the Russia case, Donald Trump, President Trump, has been really mad. It's apparently simmered for months, and then last week it burst out into the open when the president talked to the New York Times and said he wouldn't have appointed Jeff Sessions as attorney general at all if he had known he was going to recuse himself. And, you know, I think some people maybe at the time thought, well, maybe you can dismiss this as the president venting. Maybe he said something that he didn't want to say publicly. It sort of slipped out, but that has proven not to be the case. Pretty much ever since then, he's been deriding his attorney general in public, and as recently as today, fired off a couple more tweets, criticizing Jeff Sessions and how he's doing the job. It seems pretty clear he's wanting him to quit, but the president could fire him, and he's not done that yet.
And today he said that Sessions has taken a very weak position on Hillary Clinton crimes. Where are the emails and the DNC server and the intel leakers? He's talked about Ukrainian efforts to sabotage the Trump campaign. That's the first time we've heard about that, it seems to me. So he's not letting up. What does he appear to be trying to achieve? Is he trying to force Sessions to resign?
Well, it certainly appears that way. It seems like if he had his druthers, that Sessions would just step aside and the president wouldn't have to pull the trigger himself. I mean, it's hard to read these tweets any other way. It's just totally undercutting his attorney general, distracting him from the work that he had been doing. And it's kind of ironic, too, because, you know, the attorney general had been pretty dutifully carrying out the vision that Donald Trump wanted. He had been trying to crack down on illegal immigration. He had been very concerned with violent crime and implementing some new pretty harsh policies on that front that seemed to be in line with what President Trump would have wanted. So it's curious that he's fallen so far out of favor.
Jeff Sessions gave up a Senate seat in order to take this position. That's a pretty big sacrifice on his part. But the attorney general is, to some extent, supposed to be detached in a way from the White House. Does it suggest that maybe the president doesn't understand that tradition? And in the meantime, how is Sessions responding?
This president clearly values loyalty maybe above all else. I mean, I think you can see it first in the way that, you know, he's elevated his son-in-law to sort of a top foreign policy advisor position. He wants people who he trusts, and for whatever reason, he doesn't feel like Jeff Sessions fits that mold anymore. It is a little bit of an attack on the Justice Department's independence, and people inside certainly feel that way. I mean, Donald Trump is a government outsider. It's not like he came in with a deep understanding of how these institutions function, so maybe you can forgive him in some respect, but it's not like he hasn't been in the job for a while now, 6 months, right? So how is Jeff Sessions taking this? So far, he's just putting his head down. He's working. He's trying to ignore it. He hasn't really responded directly in any way after the news broke in the New York Times last week about the president not sort of regretting having appointed him. Jeff Sessions held a press conference about a big cyber case and said, I'm going to stick around here as long as it's appropriate. And since then, he's just been kind of quietly doing the work. It seems like he's sort of daring the president, hey, if you want to get rid of me, fire me.
And one theory, of course, is that if he gets rid of Sessions, who has recused himself from the Russia investigations, then he could appoint somebody who would fire Robert Mueller, the special investigator hired not by Sessions but by the deputy attorney general. A couple of people, Rudolph Giuliani and Ted Cruz, have indicated that although people have mentioned them as possible successors to Jeff Sessions, they wouldn't take the job. So it's pretty much all up in the air at the moment.
It really is. I mean, we know that the White House or White House advisors have been having what have been described to us as pretty preliminary talks or preliminary talks about replacing Sessions and who might be good for that. And you mentioned Ted Cruz and Rudy Giuliani are names that have been floated internally, but those guys sounds like don't even want the job. And gosh, it'd probably be hard to find somebody who'd right. want the job at this point. So, you know, if Jeff Sessions goes, it'll be a really chaotic situation.
In the meantime, Anthony Scaramucci, the White House Communications Director, says, no, they just need to sit down. Everything's going to be okay. Matt Zapikowski with The Washington Post. Thanks a lot for being on our show.
Thank you.
PRI, Public Radio International.